Life comes at you fast. You know, one day on a Tuesday, Duane and I were in our lawyer's office trying to get our wills put together. The next day we were in the emergency room and the doctor said, he's bleeding to death, we've got to do emergency surgery. So, you know, things really do happen unexpectedly. I mean, he was still at, you know, he'd retired from UT, but he was still active. He still had three PhD students that he was working with. He was still going in all the time. You'd never thought he'd ever retired. And he was still very, very busy and so forth. And so, you know, who was expecting this? It was totally out of the blue. An aortic dissection. His aortic, the thing that goes to your brain from the aorta, split, and he was bleeding. What? And so, luckily, he's quite aware of his own feelings in his body, and he knew he needed to go to the emergency room. But, you know, through all of this, I just kept praying, God, your will be done. Because I didn't, the surgery was 7 hours. I didn't know whether he was going to make it through it or not. His heart stopped. And the doctor reached in and massaged his heart because he was already open and got him going again. But I mean, you know, that's a pretty serious thing. But anyway, in thinking about what I wanted to say, I wanted to say that I take my marriage vows very seriously. And as Christians, I think we should. Because when you get up before God and a minister and all your friends and family and vow that you're going to leave to that other person. And that's what I've done. Sorry. This is hard to talk about. So anyway, I'm not an expert. I'm sure that a lot of other people have gone through these same things and they have different experiences than I've had. But people, when I, at the heart hospital, when people would come to see me, they say, well, how do you do this every day? You come here every day and you sit and watch him. I say, well, you know, every morning when I wake up, I ask God for strength for that day, not for a month from now or for a year from now, for that very day. And I still do that every morning because God has seen me through every day. And that's the only way I've been able to get through this. I've, you know, it's been 8 months, and every single day I've been with him, except for the one day after I fell and broke my knee. And and it's been a real journey. And I've learned a lot of things about myself and about God's mercy and God's faithfulness, because he really has been faithful to us. So, anyway, many of us have had these same experiences, but we're all different, and we all have different reactions to them. Just as a quick example, I saw a lot of people in the hospital who had nobody come to see them, except maybe once in a while. And Duane's last roommate at the nursing home that he just left, his wife lived 1 mile away. And she would come one day, one for about a few minutes every day, that's all. And she lived just a few blocks away. So, you know, you just don't know. But I felt constrained to be there every day because I was his advocate and he didn't have anybody else. Our families are all scattered around the country and we don't have children, so therefore there was nobody else to come and see him and be with him. And I think he appreciated my being there. And a lot of the people from this church, I'll tell you, there were times when I was really in the depths of despair. And I remember one time Barry and Susanna came, and I was devastated because of something one of the doctors had told me about Duane. This was very early in his experience, in our experience. And they just sat with me and prayed and gave me the support to keep it going. I mean, you know, and I cannot emphasize enough how much we need to reach out to our Christian friends, our Christian, the community, because it is so important that you have that support. You know, it's, we all expect that we're going to be supported by everybody. But, you know, when you really get to the point where you are desperate, be willing to ask for help and take it graciously. This, one of the things that this has, you know, I head the crisis care team, and one of the things this whole experience has taught me is to be a gracious receiver as well as a giver, because you know, it's very nice to be able to give to other people and so forth, and you feel good about it and so forth, and you feel like you're serving Christ. But being on the other end, and I have been on the other end, is quite different, and it's humbling. But it's something we need to learn, and I think Christ wanted me to learn that, because I've always been on the giving end, and now I was on the receiving end, and I have been so blessed by the care and the love that has been poured out to Dwayne and myself. Anyway, so let's get on to a few more experiences. Early in our experience, throughout about the first 5 months, doctors kept saying to me, "Are you sure you want to continue with his care?" And I was a little taken aback by that. But Dwayne's situation was so serious, and he had so many episodes just one complication after another, that the doctors, we had a whole panoply of doctors over these months, but a number of the doctors just didn't see any hope. And I did see hope. And I remember after, when he went to his first rehab place, the head of he had two different sessions with me, this doctor did. And he sat me down and he said, "Well, you know, I wouldn't want to live if I were in Dwayne's situation." He said he has dialysis, he's got wounds that aren't healing very well, he's got impairments and so on and so forth. He said, "I'd want my wife to let me die." He said, "Do you want to stop feeding him?" And I said, "No, I don't want you to stop feeding him." Now, the interesting thing is that Dwayne and I had talked many, many times over our lifetime together, which is a long time, about whether we would want to be kept alive on artificial means. Feeding tube, lunged, breathing, and he had all of those. He couldn't breathe on his own. He had a tube down his throat, then he had a trach. He had a trach for a long time. He has a feeding tube. And he had all of the medical things to keep him alive. And those were the things we said we didn't want to ever do. You know, but it's, when you are calm and everything is healthy, you write all these things down in your will and your directives. I don't want to do this and this and this, and I want this to be done. When it comes down to the point, do you want your loved one to die at that point? Do you want to say, "Okay, I'm going to make the decision that he's going to die"? I couldn't do that. I kept praying about it, and I said to God, "God, I turn him over to you. If it's time for him to die, it's okay." I knew he was going to heaven. Sorry. Just reliving this is kind of emotional. And I really did trust that he was in God's hands. And I said, "You know, God, I'm selfish. I would like to have him with me a little longer, a lot longer, actually. But considering our ages, that's not going to happen." But I really felt confident that I could accept that if God decided to take him to heaven, that was okay. So one day after the doctor at his first rehab place had this talk with me, I said to Dwayne, I took him outside, and he was able to talk a little bit to me at that point. And I said, "Dwayne, the doctors are not quite sure whether you really want to go on with all of this." And he looked at me and he said, "I don't want to go to heaven yet." He said, I will go when God takes me. And that was, that's what I felt, that God would take him when it was God's timing. It wasn't my decision that I should say, "Okay, I'm going to stop feeding him because that's all that's keeping him alive. I'm not going to take away the tube that goes down his trach to give him oxygen and so forth." God has to make that decision. Now, other people are going to make different kinds of decisions. This was a very personal decision that I made, and I'm not condemning anybody who makes a different decision. But this was how I had to handle it, because I really owe my allegiance to God first, and then my husband and my family and the church. And so I just left it in God's hands, and I said, "God, it's up to you. If you want to take him and he's going to be in heaven with you, I know he's going to be there with you. I can live with that, and I will mourn him, but I want him to be where you want him to be." And God said, "I'm not done with him yet." And so Anyway, so he went from the heart hospital to Texas Neuro Rehab, and then he went to a nursing rehab home, and that's where he just returned from. And they didn't have that conversation with me at this last rehab, thank goodness, because I was tired of that business. You know, the doctor had that conversation with me twice, and I kept saying, "What, you know, what are you talking about? You know, he's getting better." "Well, no, he's not really getting very, very much better." And I said, "Well, you know," and so I said, when we left there, I said, "You know, when Dwayne's walking, I'm going to bring him back in here and show him to you." And he's just about walking. He's walking with a walker now, and he's home, and you know, he can help me move him around, which is wonderful. And he's, you know, he has his sense of humor back, and he can carry on a conversation a little slowly, but you know, he's there. He's still a person. He's still God's child, and he's going to have some impairments. I know that, but I guess what I would say about that is, be prepared if you make the decisions like I have made, that you are going to keep him alive with all means, that you're going to have to live with those consequences, you know, because he's not going to ever be the way, he's not going to be the brilliant professor at UT anymore. I mean, that part of his life is accomplished. But he still is a wonderful person. He still has a sense of humor. He can still express himself. And I'm grateful for that, and I'm grateful to have him under those circumstances. But you do have to realize, I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's not going to be a bed of roses when somebody has impairments and they're going to be in a wheelchair or a walker or whatever for some period of time. That you have to realize that that's what you're signing on for. And not everybody wants to do that. But I do, and I'm grateful that I have him with me. Anyway, so what else did I want to say here? Basically, that's really it. I'm so thankful for the support that we've been given from this church, from the choir. Choir's been great. Crisis care group has been great. The small groups have been great. People have come up. When I broke my knee falling in his room, the people of this church carried me every single day for 5 weeks down to Dwayne's place and back again. I mean, that to me is just such an outpouring of care and love. I mean, I just cannot, you know, it's unbelievable. When I tell people, they say, 5 weeks? They do that every single day, 7 days a week? I said, yes, that's what our church is. This is the epitome of Christian love, as far as I can see. And besides all the other things people have done, I mean, people leave things, little treats on my door. And when we got home yesterday, Friday, there was a welcome home sign strung across our gate from Kelly Peacock. I mean, you know, people have just been so terrific, and it's just been heartwarming. But through all of this, God's love has been the one that is really the outstanding thing. God's mercy and his care. And I really feel that the care that we've given is an expression of God's care to us. And it's been carried out by all of you and by the people of this church, and I'm so grateful. But you know, that's what we're called to be. We're called to be God's hands and feet. And I can really attest to the fact that we have really received that. So anyway, and I'm joyful about all that I've gone through. It's been a hard 8 months, but it's been a learning 8 months, and I can still be joyful about it. People say, why are you still smiling? I'm smiling because God has been so great and so good and so faithful to us that it's hard to take in. You know, I've grown up a Christian all my life, and I've just sort of taken all these things for granted, but this has really brought it home to me that this is really the Christian life. This is what God calls us to do and be, the hands and feet of God's love. And through all of this, God has been so good. And I just want that's what, you know, he's just been wonderful to us. Anyway, thank you for listening to all this.
Good morning. Our experience was similar to Faith's in many ways, different in some. Because what happened to us when life came at us fast was that my husband had a freak accident. He was having a nightmare that somebody was trying to break into our house. He tried to leap out of bed to protect hearth and home, caught his feet in the covers, pitched off on his head, and broke his neck. I was upstairs at the time. I was sleeping upstairs because I had a cracked sacrum and I was in a wheelchair. He was downstairs where our bedroom is. And when he didn't come up to help me get up, I went over to the stairs in my wheelchair and said, "Hey, are you okay down there?" And he said, "Lynn, call EMS. I've broken my neck." When he first fell, he was paralyzed for several hours. He could not move. He could not speak. He couldn't call out for help. And that fortunately passed, because by the time I called down to him, he could talk again. So I called EMS. And God, in His great mercy, had seen fit to have Bob's spinal cord not severed, simply bent and bruised. And so that began 11 months of health care. In and through the health care system, we went through 3 acute care hospitals, 2 rehabilitation hospitals, and 2 nursing homes. And then Bob got to come home. And we did home health care and outpatient therapy, and now he's going to therapy just twice a month, Faith. You're going to get there. And every day of that trip, God has been with us. Everything you said, I ditto. It was the most amazing experience of God's love. And like Faith, I will tear up because I get teary every time I think about it. I've never felt so loved. Dalton, you're agreeing. That's just the way it is. Not only did he have a broken neck, but he had the wonderful repercussions that you get from treatment. So he had a broken neck, and he had surgical repair, and then he got an abscess in the surgical side, and then he got a MRSA abscess in the surgical side. So he had to have another surgery to clean it out. And after it was cleaned out, they put him on vancomycin, a wonder drug that was one of the few that would combat MRSA, and it gave him C. diff, which is a really terrible bacterial problem in your lower GI tract, and he lost about 25 pounds just like that. And after he got over C. diff, you'll notice we're doing this roller coaster pattern. After he got over C. diff, he got pneumonia. And then after he got over pneumonia, he was dependent on the ventilator. He just couldn't breathe that well. He had some nerve damage to his lungs, and he just couldn't breathe that well. So he did a tracheostomy. And at that point, they sent him to a rehab hospital, ready to get rehabilitated. But when he got to the rehab hospital, we had another whole roller coaster ride of surprises. Before we get there, let me back up a little bit. We thought we were prepared for things like this. We were wrong. We had prepared as much as we could. We had wills, we had medical directives, we had financial planning, we had, you know, we'd done the whole nine yards. We thought we'd done well. We had long-term care insurance, which I would really encourage you to have. If you can't do it, start a medical savings account, because long-term care is really expensive. It's really expensive. Even if you're just having help at home, it's expensive. And then we had 2 lists that I would encourage everybody to make if you don't have anything like this. We had 1 list that Bob had made because he just got the idea that this would be good. He had a list of all the contact information we needed. All of the emails, all the phone numbers, all the addresses of people like attorneys, doctors, financial planners, extended family, everybody. The guy who worked on our septic tank at the farm, the plumber, you know, everything. Everything is on the contact list. And how to get into things. Passwords. All those pesky passwords that you may not be able to remember. You need a master list of all of that. We had a safe with a combination lock. I lost it. I couldn't find the combination lock. And all of the papers that we had prepared in the first section here were in the safe. So because we had the list with contacts, I could get hold of everybody and get duplicates of everything that was locked up in the safe. So it's nice to have those things. And then we had another list that was a chronological list of what happens every month. In January, do this. In February, do this. In March, do this. And it was so helpful to me because Bob did most of that kind of thing. And all of our bills were on auto draw. I had once been the bill payer. They were all on auto draw. But little things like get the car inspected, get things ready for taxes, get them to the accountant, pay the long-term care insurance, all those things through the year. That was invaluable for me because I could just look at my calendar and say, okay, this month I have to do this. So that's what we thought we had done to prepare for problems. But once we got on the roller coaster, I discovered a long list of things that I had total ignorance about this long list of things. And the first thing I learned was the system, the medical system. You have so many days in each facility. They are limited by who's paying. In our case, Medicare was paying, but it might be your insurance policy. Or worst case scenario, it might be you. In which case, you better hope you have a medical savings account because it's very, very expensive. So the first thing you learn is that if you want to know how many days you have left in any given facility, you need to make really close friends with a social worker. Who would think the social worker would be the one to tell you? You have to be out of here in a week. You better get ready. Find a place to go. Know the social worker. And then Sandy Yocklin, God bless her, she gave me so much good advice. She said, you build relationships with every caregiver that you come in contact with. And so I started working on it. I learned names. You write them down. If you're like me, you can't remember them all. There's so many people that walk in that door. All of the hospitalists, all the nurses, and they change constantly. Write it down all the way down to the cleaning lady and the custodian. The custodian three times had to be contacted by me to come and fix the hospital bed because the special mattress that had the pump, that it went out. And so I had to call a custodian and say, hey, the bed's broken again. You need everybody's name. And you just need to build personal contacts with them. You can real quick. I don't have a whole lot of time. I'm going to try to say this fast. Just one example. There were several times this happened, but one example was we had a therapist in a nursing home who was young, and he was sort of bored. All those old people, most of whom were not showing much sign of improvement, many of whom were going downhill. And he was just kind of, you know, he was dealing with it, but it wasn't where he really wanted to be. And I noticed one day that his name tag said Castaneda. And I said, do you by any chance have a relative in the upholstery business? And he said, yes, my grandfather's in the upholstery business. And I said, we love that man. He is the finest man. He had educated his whole family, 10 kids, put them all through college. He was a wonderful man. And so when we said to this young guy, we love your grandfather, we respect him so much, our care did a total about face. He was invested. So in any way that you can connect with people, do it, because you go from being a piece of broken down machinery like a lawnmower to being a human being that they can connect with and care about. And it really, really makes a difference. I had no idea. Thank you, Sandy. You need to be appreciative and helpful. Thank you. You're doing a great job. Gosh, we appreciate how much you're helping. That goes a long way. Following instructions help. There were several. They throw so many instructions at you. Do this, do this, do this. And there were times when I would just think, that has got to be busy work. And Bob definitely thought some of it was busy work. And we let some things kind of slip. And the things that we let slide are the things that he is paying for today. One of them was, pull your toes up. When you walk, you pull your toes up towards your knee, don't you? You take a step and you pull your foot up. Well, when you're lying in bed in a hospital, you need to keep pulling your feet up. If you're sitting in a wheelchair, you need to keep pulling your feet up, because if you sit long enough or lie in bed long enough, those muscles in the front of your leg along your shin bone atrophy. Pretty soon you can't pull your foot up, and you have something called foot drop. And so when you walk, you catch your toe, you stumble. And Bob has that. He's still fighting that. He's still struggling with his walking. So if it seems silly, go ahead and do it anyway. Save complaints for serious issues. We had one therapist who said, when he first met me, that he determined that I was the most obnoxious woman he had ever met, and he didn't really think that he could bear to come in my husband's room and have to deal with me, because I was there all the time like Faith. We made friends later on. It got really good, and he was a wonderful man and a great therapist. But I learned that what I had been doing wrong, I was so anxious for Bob to get well, and he wasn't breathing on his own. He had to get off the ventilator, and this was the respiratory therapist. I was pushing him, pushing, 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 until he just thought, oh, just get her off my back. It wasn't his issue. It was my husband's difficulty with breathing, but it's better to go after it a little bit more kindly. Don't be too intense. I was way too intense. Like Faith, we had some hard questions. The same doctor approached us and said, you know, your husband's really fragile, and anything could take him out. Do you want to put a do not resuscitate order on his chart? And I said, and that means? And he said, well, that means that, you know, if he, for instance, had cardiac arrest, we just wouldn't try to start his heart again. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. He's not in a vegetative state. He's not about to die. He's sick. All right, but no, I don't want to do that. For two reasons. I wanted my husband alive, right? And for the second reason is that in care facilities, nursing homes especially, and rehab hospitals also, nights and weekends, that's usually when a crisis comes. At least in our family, it's always been. Your kid doesn't get sick and have temperature 104 on Monday morning at 10 o'clock when the pediatrician's in the office. They do that on Friday at midnight, right? So I figured if he was going to have a crisis, that's when it would happen. Wee hours of the morning, probably, and that is not when the A-team is on duty. That is when care is spotty, maybe non-existent. That's not when I want a life and death decision made for somebody that I love. So we didn't do that. If you've got a spouse in a hospital or a nursing care facility, I learned that you need to be observant, really observant, because you know this person like nobody else knows them. So, example, one morning I walked into Seton ICU, and Bob, of course, had tubes coming out of everything. He was drugged. He was really, really sick, but he looked funny. He didn't look right. I looked at him, and his eyes were sort of glassy and glazed, and I thought, you know, there's something wrong with him. Of course, there was obviously a lot wrong with him, but there was something new wrong with him. And so I said to the nurse, would you look at him? He didn't look right. There's something wrong with him. And he looked at him, and he said, yeah, there's something wrong with him, and I think I know what it is. He said, this happens sometimes in this situation. His blood sugar had just run amok, and it was easily fixable, but if it had been left, it could have become really serious. So you're the one who knows this person. It's good to take notes. Write down any questions that you might have. There's not always a doctor or even a caregiver around, so if you've got a phone, or I kept a notebook. I had an ancient flip phone at the time. It was not good for note keeping. But if you have a way to keep notes and say, you know, what are you going to do about this? Or I noticed that. It sure does help, because there's so much going on. There's so many crises that keep coming up. And if you have that information there when the doctor walks in the room, you can open your notebook and say, hey, what about? One of the things we had to deal with, and I imagine you did too, but our situation was a little different because the care team was not set up at the time that Bob fell. And people on the care team, you guys are wonderful. It's made a huge difference for people. Just watching your experience and knowing what our experience was, it's a lot better. We had lived in Austin almost all our married life, and we had a lot of Christian friends. So the body of Christ, I'm happy to say, functions outside of Redeemer. All of our old Christian friends with Redeemer people were our body of Christ, so we had sort of an extended body of Christ. But we had a lot of phone calls. And so first a friend sent out email notifications to this list that was growing. And then our daughter put us on Caring Bridge. And it is such a gift from God. It is so wonderful. Because with Caring Bridge, I just would post how Bob was doing. I didn't have to repeat the same thing over and over and over again. And then I got updates from everybody that was following him. I got prayers, I got notes, I got wonderful encouragement and help from people. And I was able to put on my post what God was doing for us. You talk about a bully pulpit. You have people listening to you when you're going through a disaster, and they're willing to hear you talk about Jesus in a way that they're not particularly interested in doing if everything's going great. If your life is peachy, they look at you and say, yeah, your life is fine. You can talk to me about God. You can talk to me about Jesus. My life is not so fine. But if your life is a disaster, they can't say that to you. So it's an opportunity to tell people, and here's when I will lose it, how good our God is. Every single day, it was just one blessing after another. Little blessings, big blessings. He just dropped good things on us continuously. And the body of Christ, this body of Christ, and our other body of Christ from other churches in the past, just overwhelmed us with the love of God. It's the most amazing thing. I've never, ever experienced anything like it. And so, although it was a really tough time, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I just want to say a few things about tender loving care that we give to each other. God gave us all of His tender loving care, and the body of Christ did to both of us. But for your spouse, you know them better than anybody else. You know what they want and need. My husband is an introvert, and so he didn't need a lot of company all the time because he's one of those people that a lot of people, it drains his energy. Extroverts gain energy from people, so I had to know that about him. But when somebody's in the hospital for a long time, as our husbands were, it's like being in jail. Bob called it his incarceration. He really felt that way about it. It's this one little room. You're closed in. It's a surreal environment. If you've spent a lot of time sitting with somebody in a hospital, it's surreal. I can remember walking out and going to the grocery store and thinking, life, real life. It feels so good to get out of that environment. And so anything you can do for your spouse to bring in life, their regular life, their ordinary life. I put up a lot of pictures on printer paper that I printed off the computer of our kids and our farm and his garden and things that he loved so that he could just look at them and think, oh, that's me. I used to do that. There's our family. There's all these good things. And it also helped the staff to know who he was. Oh, he's the guy with the garden. You know, he's the guy with the little grandkids that are going down to put boats in the water, you know, that kind of thing. Anything your spouse likes to do, if it's games or movies or reading or whatever, just do it. Bring them music, whatever they like. Help them to communicate. I don't know about Dwayne, but Bob couldn't talk for months because he was hooked up to a ventilator. Yeah. Anyway, so he needed something, some way to communicate. So our son suggested we get him a little whiteboard so he could write out messages or commands, as the case may be. Our daughter said that when she was staying with him right at first at Brackenridge, he couldn't drink for a long, long time, and he could only moisten his mouth with a sponge. And she said she'd be sitting there, and just as she was drifting off to sleep, he'd say, "Sponge!" And she'd have to jump up and get him a sponge. But he was a good patient. He never complained. He always did what people asked him to do. Much better patient than I would ever have been. Amazing. If you're the caregiver, you need to be dependable and consistent. We were blessed, Faith, in that we had the ability to be with our husbands all the time.
Not everybody has that.
Not everybody has that. If you work full-time, if you've got kids at home, you can't be there all the time. But be there as much as you can, because, like this poor man, his wife came for just a few minutes once a day. It's lonely in jail. You have a lot of caregivers coming in and out, but you need somebody with you as your companion, as your advocate, and as your cheerleader. Everybody needs a cheerleader to come in and say, "What? You sat in your chair 15 more minutes? Congratulations, that's wonderful. You walked to the end of the hall? That's great. I'm so proud of you," because don't we all need that in everyday life for somebody to say, "Hey, you did a great job." Well, when you're sick and you don't have much strength left, every little success is a big success. It's important. Sometimes you have to be tough. I had to tell Bob at one point when he was in a rehab hospital, if you don't get off the ventilator, you have to go to a nursing home in either San Antonio or Dallas, because at that point there are two nursing homes in the state of Texas that will take you on a ventilator. He'd been kind of drifting, you know. He liked his ventilator. It kept him, he could get air. It's a scary thing not to be able to get air. But once he heard that, he got off the ventilator. It's amazing. You need to learn all you can. Go to care plan meetings, ask questions. And if you are approaching a move, as you sometimes are unexpectedly, if you haven't kept up with the caseworker and the social worker, you need to go out and investigate what's available. You can look online, you can get ideas, but you need to go in person and look at the place. What's online and what's really there are not always the same. They can vary widely. And if you don't have time to do that, Emery McEwen and Jill Essex both used a man who is a professional care finder. They have information, if you ever need that, how to get in touch with somebody like that. This man found a place for Glenn, because Jill was working full-time. Found a place for Emery here in Austin because he was in Georgia. So that's really helpful. Need to know what you need. People are always saying, "Are you taking care of yourself?" Aren't they, Faith? And you think, "What are you talking about?" Well, you need to keep up your relationship with the Lord. You need time with Him. You need time in the Word. You need your spirit fed. But you also need your body fed properly. You don't need to be eating out of vending machines. And it's easy to get into that. You need to eat well. You need to exercise as much as you can. If it's just walking up and down the hospital corridor, if you can get outside, it's better. But exercise relieves stress so well. It just makes a huge difference to be able to move and exercise. If you sit there in that hospital recliner for very long, you're going to turn to stone. Your muscles are going to atrophy. I mean, it's just exhausting to sit in a recliner all day. So take care of yourself and give yourself some mental R&R. For me, it was my Bible and books and music and friends. You just need to take your mind off of it sometimes. You get so absorbed and so obsessed with this terrible disaster and how it's going to get better, and it's so hard to put it down. But if you can pick up, for me, it was picking up a book, going to another place, another world, another time, and just, I was out of there, and it gave my mind a break. Talk to friends. Some of them will listen to your problems, and some of them will take your mind off of them. They're wonderful both ways. Seek, to me, this was very helpful. Seek the counsel of people who have been there. Two women whom I have never met to this day, but who were connected with me by friends, spent hours with me on the phone. One woman was in Dallas, another woman was someplace else, and she spent hours with me on the phone saying, "Okay, we've done this, and this is how we work through it." It was amazing how much help they gave me.
Lynn was my support, because she just walked me through so many of these things. I was so grateful that she'd already gone through all of this with Bob, and so she was so helpful to me, because she kept sort of saying, "Okay, don't let this get you down. Do this and that," and so forth. So anyway, I really heartily endorse what you're saying.
Thank you.
Because you were great to me.
They were wonderful. And I still hear from one of them every once in a while. And she's still taking care of her husband, who is in much worse shape than either of our husbands, Faith. So, amazing. Accept volunteer help. Be glad for it. Hire help if you have to. You can do that as well. I did that. Be able to say goodnight or leave when you have to. My husband was like, when I left, it was like putting a little kid to bed at night. You know how they are? Could you just tell me one more story? I'm thirsty. With him, it was, could you just fix my pillow? Could you just rub my head just for a minute? Would you just hold my hand just for a minute before you leave? And it was so hard to leave. But sometimes you have to leave. You got to go take care of life outside of the hospital. The last part of the journey is homecoming, and that's where faith is. I think for us, we took short visits before we came home because Bob made 6 moves within his treatment period, and moves are traumatic. They rank right up there with birth and death and divorce and things like that. Losing your job. It's a trauma to move. So when he came home, we came home for a little while and then went back, came home for an afternoon or a morning, and then came home for the big move. And then for you, real quick, you need to learn what you need to do when you get your patient home. Your sweet spouse does not have their support team anymore. You have lost the nurses and the aides and the therapists, and you only are the caregiver. And it's kind of daunting sometimes. Faith and Dwayne have been through a fall.
I dumped my husband on the garage floor getting him out of the car when he was driving home.
We had a bout of stomach virus. And I was upstairs fixing breakfast and heard this huge thud downstairs and went downstairs and Bob was unconscious on the bathroom floor with his head on the scale. And when he came to, he said, would you fix this pillow? It is really hard. So I called Emory McEwen, which is what Bob did. I mean, which is what Faith did. You call Emory McEwen, but things aren't going well because we didn't want to call EMS. Anyway, just know that when you come home, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be dicey sometimes. The system will provide some things for you. We had a lot of hard equipment, beds and wheelchairs and things provided by Medicare. They weren't as kind to you.
No, they don't provide hospital beds or anything anymore.
I'm really sorry.
It's okay.
And the last thing is don't expect too much too fast. I think we have a tendency to think, gosh, when they walk in the door, everything's going to be peachy again. And it's really not instantly peachy again. There's still a long way to go. You've still got home health care. You've still got outpatient therapy. You've still got things to deal with. I learned the hard way that there's a fine line between being a cheerleader and a nag. It's easy in the hospital. The therapists and people like that are praising your spouse. But when you get them home, it goes from being great job to, have you done your exercises yet? To, when are you going to do your exercises? You mean you still haven't done your exercises? And it gets to be kind of naggy after a while. So it's really, you have to be careful with that. And you need, Faith, you talked about this so beautifully. You're probably looking at a new normal. We certainly were because our husbands are not young. If you're young, you may go back and be just as good as you were before. But if you're not young, you may have a new normal to adjust to. You may not be able to do everything. Bob will never play golf again. A grief to his heart and a loss. He's just not going to play golf. His balance is so impaired that a full golf swing would take him down. He's not going to be using a chainsaw again. He loves to do things like that on a ranch. He loves to cut firewood. He loves to lift rocks. He loves to do all this stuff. He's going to have to be satisfied with a tractor and the weed eater. It's just the way it is. And I think what we're trying to concentrate on is what he's got, what he's gained, what God has given us. All blessings, so many, many, many blessings. And not focus on what we don't have anymore. Our journey was 11 months to the day, from the time Bob fell till the time he came home. And every single day, God's faithful presence and his provision was there. God and the body of Christ, without them, we would never have made it. It would have been impossible. Special thanks are due, although they are not here, to Sandy Yocklin for her advice and her wisdom, and Emory McEwen, who, if you don't know, came and stayed with my husband every night. Not every night, twice a week. He came and stayed twice a week for 12-hour shifts with Bob in the rehab hospital and in the nursing home. Twice a week for 12-hour shifts for months. That is so above and beyond. I can't imagine being able to do that. And I appreciate it so much. And special thanks to our children, John and Jennifer, who were magnificent. I'm so proud of them. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it.
This is just two ladies in our church, and you
heard and lots more
that have been through this kind of thing, and they're kind of a light out there. Mm-hmm. Today, you're probably not having these problems. You're not probably not even worried about it. Some of you, you're so young and you got all this life ahead of you. But know that within this church, there are people that can help you with these kind of real practical problems you're going to run into. It'll be important someday, even if it's not today. I know Phil and Dalton know that.
Yeah.
And the body of Christ, people know finances, people know estate planning, there's people that know, all of us know Jesus, mm-hmm. How to pray for one another. And when that time, whatever your circumstances are, just know you're surrounded by people who've got, they've got experience, they've been there, they've hurt, and they've been comforted by God with the comfort that they will comfort you with. They will use that same comfort they received to give you. I don't know if either one of you, I don't remember if you mentioned this, don't hold back on asking for, mm-hmm. man, I need help. Mm-hmm. Raise your hand and people will come running. Tell them to go away and they'll go away. You know, sometimes you can get overwhelmed by people meaning well, but churches, God's blessed this church with a variety of gifts, really practical things that we're all going to need to draw on someday. So here's at least two ladies and others in the church that you can turn to when these kinds of things. If you have any questions for them in particular, I'll get out of the way and let them ask those questions. But I want to thank you both. I know this is a tender subject, and I know it's an emotional experience to go through, draining, spiritual, just test everything within you, and like both of you said, God was there every day, mm-hmm. blessing you.